We're talking about these qualities. We've been talking for several weeks now about essentially wholesome qualities or qualities of the heart-mind that are valuable to cultivate in practice. And these qualities partly are part of a list called the perfections, which is a little bit like, you know, like an Irish band from the 80s. There must have been one, but it would be, you know, a slightly Buddhist-oriented band if it was. Come on in, y'all. Yeah. These perfections are qualities that in the Mahayana tradition, it's said that the Buddha spent many, many eons perfecting. So in lifetime after lifetime, working on these qualities, building up their strength as he prepared to become the Buddha that we know. And they form in part a set of orientations for spiritual practice. So the first one is the perfection of giving, really learning to lean into our natural generosity in an abundant and full way. The perfection of ethical action or virtue, learning how to orient through our actions toward the wholesome or toward well-being. Really learning to respect the truth of cause and effect, or of action and result, knowing that all of our actions and inaction has results, and that our actions or lack of actions join the stream of conditions that give rise to the next moment. And this is sort of the seed of where we'll go tonight. Tonight the theme is patience, sort of. But that's the quality, the perfection. But starting with this piece about action and its results. The theory of karma in the early tradition speaks to how actions, and actions for the Buddha means volitional actions, so things you do on purpose. In other traditions of the time, like the Jaina tradition, or sometimes the Jain tradition, it was thought that actions were anything that you did at all, even if not intentional. So like, if you were walking along and you accidentally stepped on a bug, you would still have the karma of killing, which is a heavy karma to bear, and that will come back to you in some repercussions. And because of that, that tradition, the Jain tradition, was particular about, you know, the discipline of like walking along a path. So like a very careful practice that some practitioners in that lineage do would be to sweep the path in front of them back and forth as they walked to try to get to better ensure that no accidental killing happened. So the Buddha's view was different than this, and he said that karma or the repercussions of your actions come from volitional actions and not from non-volitional ones, not from accidental actions or you know, ordinary physiology. This is good, right? You know, in my body, we now know that there are some percentage of the body that's way bigger than you think, like, you know, 70% or something of the mass of your body is composed of microscopic beings whose DNA is different from yours, what we call yours. So like the microbiome, the bacteria and all that makes up my body, you know, they're getting born and dying all the time. You know, if I, you know, take a couple drops of grapefruit seed extract because I have a little upset stomach, I kill off, you know, a gazillion beings in my gut. And, you know, like a mass murder of bacterial beings, you know. You know, and then I eat some yogurt and I give birth to a gazillion more new ones. So the Buddha's theory of karma is that that's not killing, right? That's just life unfolding. Like, you're part of an ecosystem. But karma unfolds, and karma really means the lawful flow of action and its results unfolds in part through our own volition. So how we act, what we do. And so the perfection of ethical practice or virtue is really about looking at our actions, how we harm or protect beings, how we respect others' property, others' bodies. We respect others through our words, through the use of sexuality, through the use of intoxicants. We are wise and in some way restrained from some of the natural impulses we might have, so as to orient our actions toward the wholesome or toward well-being. And so then the next of the perfections is renunciation, or letting go. The practice of being willing to, I like to think of renunciation as the practice of being willing to grow out of or mature out of harmful habits that no longer serve me or others. And so the perfections unfold like this as a kind of interwoven collection of qualities that are really practices. Each one of them is a practice, something to take on, to investigate, to let open in our life. And with each of them, if we really take it on as a practice, it will shift us. It will shift our habitual actions. It'll shift our relationships. It'll shift and kind of unearth some of the, you know, bad habits that we carry around with us. So the next of the perfections that I want to touch into, the next in the list for tonight, is patience. The Pali word is kanti. The parallel Sanskrit word is kshanti. And patience is one of the common translations. But the other common translation is this nice old Victorian word, forbearance. Forbearance. And I want to talk a little bit about forbearance, a word you have perhaps never used, right? Like, why would you? But it's a skill you actually have, in part, as mature adults, wherever on the spectrum of mature adults you find yourself, you have this to some extent. But let's talk about patience first, like this ordinary thing, patience. What is patience? Patience is what I have when things are happening not exactly as I want, and particularly not as quickly as I want. Like, I want something to happen, it's not happening yet, and I'm okay with that. So patience is the kind of, like, I'm willing to chill here with things being imperfect, because I'm waiting for a future arrival of something. So we say, like, oh, I'm just being patient. He was a very patient person. She was a very patient person. And it's a positive quality. We think of it as a positive quality. Certainly we think of impatient as a not positive quality. But we rarely look at the way that what it means, in part, is that we can tolerate the unpleasant. That's really the heart of patience, right? You're patient because things are not yet how you want them. And so you are willing to hang out with things being not how you want them for whatever reason, because you have faith that they're going to be how you want, or you've given up on letting them be how you want, whatever you've come to in yourself that allows you to do that. But it would sound very different if, you know, instead of saying, oh, you know, he was a very patient person, if we said, oh, he's really good at tolerating discomfort. Okay? It has a different ring to it. But it's actually the same thing. One of the truths of discomfort, the Buddhist word, of course, would be suffering or distress, dukkha. One of the truths of discomfort is that it doesn't last. So, like, whatever particular discomfort you're in right now, whether it's the discomfort of kind of body aches or heartbreak or aging or something happening in your family or your friend crew, If there's anything that you might know, that you might come to through wisdom practice, is that it's that this discomfort, whatever it is, can't last. And that doesn't mean it'll get better, but it means it can't last. So it might get worse, for instance, but that means it's changed at least, right? Oh, I'm so glad I can't really feel my headache anymore. It's like, oh, that's great. Your headache went away. It's like, well, no, it didn't go away, but I broke my leg. And that hurts a lot. So now I can't feel my headache, you know. Or I'm aging. This is really painful. And, you know, so it says, well, it won't last. You know, well, yeah, it won't it? But the reason that it won't, we might think of as worse. So I'm like, well, I want it to last. So I'm going to be patient with it. Because I'm not in a hurry to get to the other end. So forbearance, then, as a parallel translation for the word, kanti, this perfection of patience, the bearing it part really, it emphasizes this tolerating the discomfort aspect of patience. So it's not just that, like, I'm patient, meaning I'm like, I'm really okay to wait, you know, another week or so before Doctor Strange comes out, you know, so that we can go and see a new Marvel movie, right? And you know, it's like, it'll be fun. But I hear it's got all sorts of like Orientalist problems, and it's challenging too. But Tilda Swinton is the guru, is the Himalayan guru, so, you know, it's simultaneously terrible and fabulous at the same time. But like, okay, so there's patient, like I'm patient, waiting for that. But that's not really the perfection, I think, that the Buddha is talking about. That's a kind of like, I can tolerate the ups and downs in my relatively easy life. Forbearance is a nice translation because it actually points to a very powerful quality. And that powerful quality is tolerating the discomfort or pain, not just the sort of little fluctuations of pleasure and pain that are happening until you get what you want. And please tell me when you get what you want, because, you know, it's rare. It's not just that you're tolerating those little fluctuations, but at the heart of Buddhist practice is the renunciation of grasping at things being different than they are at all. Like letting go of things, letting go of fixing things at all. And this is a renunciate stance. This is traditionally a stance taken fully only by monastics, by monks and nuns, by folks who are living in a kind of organized poverty and celibacy and not owning anything. Partly because if we were to do it, those of us who are not monastics, you can't really function in your life. Like in the early system, it was said that if you develop this kind of letting go to a significant degree, where like you're no longer interested in the pleasures of power or sex or money or family or productivity or work or creativity, you can't really function. Like, it's hard to earn money if you're not interested in money. It's hard to take care of your family if you're not craving some kind of, you know, material state for them. So then, in the earliest tradition, it was said, oh, if you develop this quality of renunciation and accepting contentment, really, with anything, pretty soon you just become a monk or a nun. You go off to join the order, because it's the place for people who have developed that quality that fully. And the rest of us need to actually not go that far with it, because we have to keep earning money and, you know, staying interested in the work world and relationship, etc. So, forbearance then, patience, is not just patience with the ordinary fluctuation of things, but it's actually patience, I think, in the earliest system, with the pain, the really like the serious discomfort of the ascetic life. Like, you've chosen to give up the comforts of the home life. And in your practice of working toward deep equanimity, deep acceptance of things as they are, you're going to tolerate all sorts of discomfort, right? You only have three robes to live in. It's cold in the wintertime, right? You go walking for alms in the morning with one bowl, and you go to poor houses or rich houses, and you don't choose. It's against the rules to choose which house you go to. So then you get whatever you get, and one day you get an old moldy mango, and the next day you get a big pile of goat meat curry. And it's uncomfortable, right? You live outside, you know, you live in the forest under a mosquito net umbrella. But it's pretty uncomfortable in many cases. So forbearance, in part, is actually patience with that kind of discomfort. The discomforts of practice. If we were to apply that to what we do here, it would be something like, you know, like you decide to go on retreat and sit for, you know, 8 hours in a day, you know, in chunks. But you're going to sit for an hour and then walk for an hour, sit for an hour. And that's that can be very uncomfortable. The body gets tired or achy. The mind gets bored or restless or confused. And forbearance or patience is actually the quality that enables you to stay with it, to actually say, like, this is my practice, I'm sticking with it, I don't like it right now, right? This is the forbearance, or this kind of patience is the patience that says, you know, I committed to myself to come to yoga class 3 times a week, all year, no matter what, and here it is, you know, Friday morning, I don't want to go, I'm going to go, and you just go. You know, whatever your commitment is, right? I'm going to sit every morning, or I'm going to, you know, be home by 6 to the family dinner table. I mean, whatever your commitment is, forbearance is the quality that allows you to do it. So it relates to effort, it relates to perseverance. It relates to how we subdue or calm, in a way, our natural flinching in the face of discomfort, right? Our bodies, our animal being automatically doesn't like pain. It's just how the animal being works, right? Plants don't like pain. So much more our bodies, all the animals don't like pain and like pleasure. And part of practice, if what we want to do is be liberated from the rounds of birth and death, from the constant sense that we're pushed around by unfolding conditions, not just for this lifetime, but for endless lifetimes, if you take that belief on. Part of extricating ourselves from that has to be, in this system, shifting our relationship to that kind of primal grasping for ease and pleasure. And the system doesn't say that it's wrong to do so. It simply says that grasping for pleasures, when they're out of balance to physical reality, lead to distress or suffering. So it's not that wanting to be comfortable itself is a problem. It's actually not a problem at all. But when we organize our entire life around a search for a final, lasting, perfect safety and comfort, the intensity of that search is going to bring an intensity of suffering. For like half a second, I thought that was like a coyote. And I was just like, yeah. And I was like, no, there's no coyotes here howling in Berkeley. There might be, but that was not one. I know. My first Zen center was a very suffery kind of place, but it was in the mountains of northern New Mexico in a canyon. And we'd be sitting there, and during the New Mexico monsoon, it'd be raining, you can hear the river outside. It was an old Catholic monastery, kind of peeling stucco on the walls. And we'd sit on a night like this and just sit. It was so quiet. And then you would hear this like howl kind of up from the mesa. So I want to shift text just slightly for a few minutes and go a teeny bit political. And I'm going to say something about mindfulness, this great new buzzword that the tech folks are in love with, mindfulness. Mindfulness is everywhere. You don't need me to tell you that. And I want to propose a little bit that the contemporary sort of fad for mindfulness is a little confused. And for one particular reason, there's several reasonable critiques of it, but I'm going to come in from a philosophical side, and in relation to this kind of forbearance or tolerating discomfort aspect, mindfulness as one of the qualities taught in the Buddhist system consists of, in a way, the witness quality of attention. So the way that in any moment you can notice what's happening without doing anything about it. So I can notice that my back slightly aches, I can notice the brightness of the lights, I can notice the look of each person or the reflections on the floor, the sound of a non-coyote, whatever it is. I can notice the mind going, coyote, not a coyote. You can notice thoughts. I can notice, oh, now I'm planning what's going to happen next week, or now I'm remembering something that happened earlier today. And you can notice all of this. So the quality of mind that does the noticing is mindfulness. Mindfulness by itself doesn't tell us what to do with anything that happens, right? So I notice that the lights are bright. Mindfulness simply notices that. Mindfulness also notices that, like, given exactly where I'm sitting and exactly the lights, there's something, somehow, it's one of the, or two of them is very slightly too bright for my preference right now. I don't like it. So there's a very tiny discomfort. Mindfulness notices the discomfort. And that's all. And one of the ways that mindfulness is being used right now is that when you do this, if you spend some time noticing what's happening without fixing it, it is calming, right? Because our habit is to run around habitually, instantly trying to fix everything. As soon as I feel a discomfort, rushing to change it. Somebody fix the lights, fix the temperature, change it, give me a spine rolly, make the traffic stop, invite some coyotes, like make this what I want it to be. And so rarely do we stop doing that, right? We get hungry and within 3 seconds we're at the fridge. Right? We get tired and, you know, within moments we either have a cup of coffee or we have the eye pillow on for a nap or we're doing something to kind of manipulate our experience. And mindfulness says, hey, for a little bit, don't do that. Just notice what's happening and notice that it changes, right? A minute ago, I was kind of bugged by the bright light. I'm not actually bugged anymore. So, like, the light is still bright, but my distaste of it kind of crested and passed, and it's actually gone. I don't mind right now. It could come back. And then I would want to notice it. So mindfulness just does this noticing. So it's good in that way. Like, it relieves stress a little bit. But mindfulness in the Buddhist system is a quality of mind
that is like many of these perfections, and the way that it's like how I'm emphasizing patience, connected in part to the renunciate vow. So mindfulness is a quality present when you are noticing what's happening and not doing something about it. Like, oh, I'm noticing that I'm slightly uncomfortable, and I'm okay with that. I have forbearance. I'm just tolerating my practice unfolding however it does. I'm not intervening all the time. So mindfulness is linked, at least in part, to a kind of inactivity, right? It's an observing stance rather than an active stance. And these two positions, I call them mover and witness, or observer and actor. You could use actor and audience even. I like the term witness. The witness stance is the mindfulness stance. And to act is another thing, is a whole other step, right? I notice that the lights are bright, and I can do two things. I can either have forbearance or patience, and I can be like, yep, they're bright, but it's my practice to sit here. It's actually fine. I can tolerate it. And what happens as I do that is I actually ride through the wave of grasping or wishing that things were different, and I allow that to settle. There's the possibility, anyway, that my resistance to reality settles. And the result is that I'm happier. I'm like, oh, I don't have to run around and sort of adjust the lights, and then there'll just be some other thing that is slightly not what I want. So like, oh, I let go of changing things, and I actually become happier because I have less to do. The window of what feels, you know, comfortable for me opens, or tolerable for me opens. And pretty soon I'm less anxious, right? I'm more at ease with my life. Anxiety is essentially a kind of obsessive worry about what will happen or wishing that things were otherwise. So I stopped doing that somewhat. So for all those reasons, mindfulness is great. So why am I grumpy about modern mindfulness? Partly because it's being introduced in the context of business with a subtext of productivity. And the subtext is, if you get happy by being less anxious, you'll work better. And so first of all, just from a precise philosophical point of view, I want to argue with that and be like, oh, mindfulness actually promotes not action rather than more action. So to learn how to do more action, like maybe you should be a little bit mindful and then turn off your mindfulness and like go to work. Someone comes in and says, you know, did you respond to my email? And you're like, no, I was just mindful of it arising in the inbox. You know, and I was just aware of you know, the cresting feeling of obligation. And I just watched that feeling of obligation arise and pass like clouds in the sky, you know. And now the email is still there, but I don't feel bad about it. You know, I feel fine, actually. So this is not useful, right? In a certain way, mindfulness is not useful. It is the quintessential not productive quality. So it makes you happier, but it won't make you more productive. So that's one complaint, is like, I'm not actually sure how it works in a productivity environment, unless you teach it in a very fuzzy way. But the real complaint is this, that, and this is not my, I didn't invent this, but I agree with the folks who emphasize this, that that mindfulness as primarily a witness technique can be taught as if it is supposed to be the thing you do all the time, be mindful through all activities. And it's being taught in situations like corporations, say, but the military also, other places, where for instance, it's very difficult, say, to form a union and, you know, advocate for better working conditions. And so one of the critiques that's out there is oh, this is actually a very good way to teach people to be passive in relation to their external conditions. Because if you're just accepting things as they come and go, you can be like, well, you know, they're making me work 80 hours a week, and, you know, I don't really get good breaks, but they give me these mindfulness classes, and you know, I feel more at ease with discomfort. And so there's a, I'm mentioning it in a way just to say that patience or forbearance or renunciation of wishing things were different, or all of these core qualities that are about letting go, are actually context specific. They're specific to spiritual practice or transpersonal practice or undoing the psyche practice. They're not universal unless you are a renunciate. So that I don't want to, I want to push against slightly a popular teaching that says that for all of us, you know, in our busy lives, that letting go is the core thing to do. That, like, that's Buddhist wisdom. Let go, stop grasping, be mindful. And propose that those things are very, very good, and they will liberate us from much suffering. But they are also specific to the parts of our practice that are about letting go, right? So, like, I want to practice letting go of, you know, what's a good thing to let go of? Wanting to be right all the time. It's a good thing. Practice letting go of that. But I don't want to practice letting go of, you know, knowing how to have good boundaries, you know, with others. Or I don't want to practice letting go of doing my work in the way that it needs to be done, including even if that work is competitive sometimes, you know, depending on what my field is. I don't want to let go of, I want to let go of needing to please everybody. It's a great thing to let go of. But I don't want to become emotionally neutral in my primary relationship, right? And I have some tendencies in this direction. And many of my teachers have as well. My teacher Jack talks about coming back from being a monk in Thailand for many years and having a sweetheart, and the sweetheart saying, you know, where do you want to go for dinner, love? And him being like, I really have no preferences. and her being like, that doesn't work, you know, because then I have to have preferences for both of us, and that's unfair. You have to just have a preference. And I did the exact same thing, like, there's a part of me that really doesn't care where we go to dinner. Like, really doesn't care. Like, it's fine. But I learned that wasn't a useful response with friends and lovers and family. So now when someone says, where do you want to go to dinner? I kind of just pick something. And I'm like, Thai, you know, tacos. Like, because it's going to be fine regardless. And then if someone else says, oh, I don't want that tonight. How about pizza? I'm like, sure, right? Forbearance. So that was a little bit of a tangent. That was me sort of shooting an arrow at the windmill of corporate America. But to point out this thing about renunciation, that these teachings that say just notice things as they come and go are specific and not general. Right, so I want us to start to kind of as we cultivate them, to be awake to their implications and to be curious about how we apply them in different areas of our life. Right. So, as I suppose that leads to the old saying, you know, have faith in God, but tie your horse to the post. It would be something like, be mindful, but, you know, agitate, form a union. Mm-hmm. Like, don't just accept your bad conditions with a kind of mindful passivity, right? Mindfulness is for the inner life, not necessarily for the outer life. Something like that. So, thanks for listening. I hope it makes sense, at least somewhat. Let's just open to questions, reflections. things this bubbles up in you, or things that make you grumpy, particularly. Here's some other voices. What do you think in this realm? Yeah.
So would you say that having patience and perseverance is the same thing as being obedient?
Right. Sometimes, right? What do you think?
I think it is. By the way that you were describing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, does obedience mean like I'm willing to do what I'm told whether I like it or not? And
yeah.
Often I don't. So that's 'cause otherwise why would I have to obey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obedience, like, it seems a little bit harsher than patience or forbearance, but
right. Yeah. It's almost like they're the same quality, but obedience has a sort of external force,
mm-hmm.
like domming me.
Mm-hmm.
The way that, you know, the way that, like, a religious way to say it would be, thank you, yeah, it's a little stuffy. A religious way to say it would be, like, you know, to obey God,
mm-hmm.
right? Or I could just say, in more Buddhist language, like, be patient with the unfolding of karma as it happens,
yeah.
But that would be almost, it would be almost the same thing,
okay.
Right? Like, give yourself over to the natural flow of things. But it's a good reflection in relation to this thing about, like, you know, big authority figures like corporations or sort of, you know, things that should be resisted, right? Like, don't have forbearance. Don't have patience in a certain way in relation to, like, the big oppressions, right, of our time. Like, oh, no, those are things to resist, not to just be like, I can tolerate this discomfort. Maybe we need both. Like, you have to tolerate the discomfort or else you go crazy and then resist it at the same time. Yeah.
Reminds me of the discussion of how, like, there's a divine abode. I think it's a divine abode, and there's things that are near cousins but are not them.
Yeah.
So, like, how equanimity is not the same as apathy.
Yes.
But sometimes there can be some confusion, you know.
Yeah. Like, yeah, the near enemy.
Totally. So I wonder if... You know, it's interesting, because I always think of mindfulness. It's like if I was aware of inequity or injustice.
Yeah.
That I almost could do nothing but respond to
it. Yeah, truly.
I was truly, like, aware of it.
Truly. I think so. I hope so. When I think about it that way, and I do also think about it that way, it's almost like our practice consists of this oscillation between action and witness. Like, and maybe it happens very fast, like they're almost simultaneous. But I'm aware of what's happening, and I choose to act. I'm aware of what's happening, and I choose to act. And the aware is by its nature passive, right? It's just kind of pure perception. And then the action kind of jumps in, makes a choice, does something. And they oscillate. And this would be understanding reality this way would be a very kind of tantric way to understand it, where, like, pure awareness is Shiva and pure manifestation and action is Shakti. And they're really one being, but the vibration between them is this kind of hum or sound or pulsation. I think part of the rub for me in the sort of popularizing of mindfulness is that the stress-relieving aspect of just the witness side of that dyad is emphasized. And so, and it's mostly taught in the context of sitting meditation, where you're not really, it's not like it's being taught, become mindful of oppression, then do something. It's being taught, you know, become mindful of your anxious thoughts and let them go. So So I'm absolutely in agreement with what you're saying. Like that's what I would want, is that awareness and action are in a wholesome way intertwined.
Yeah, or you can be like, so this is happening. I'm not reacting to it. I mean, potentially you get to a point and be like, this inequality is happening. It's sad, and if it's happening, I'm not going to like...
Yeah.
I don't have a little bit of feedback. Like, equanimity is a little hard for me to like describe or get my mind around, but...
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean I don't have to care or I don't have to respond to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Equanimity is subtle that way, right? Because non-reactivity and engaged compassion can actually be right there at the same, like, you know, I can be not wrecked by it and at the same time wrecked by it, right? If the heart is open. It's why equanimity is one of the heart qualities, even though it seems like a kind of really neutral thing. It's actually a close cousin of kindness and compassion and joy. Yeah, thank you. Other thoughts here?
No, I was thinking, you know, it's like noticing when someone is saying or doing something.
Yeah.
And instead of la 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 la, you know, mm-hmm. actually being aware of the effects that is having on the people involved and saying
yeah.
something, you
yeah.
know. Someone's being unkind or creepy.
Yeah. yeah. Not voting for them.
You're not voting for them. Or,
yeah.
you know, or saying that,
saying.
You know, hey, that's not all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So learning how to bridge the sort of discomfort gap between the witness and active positions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is sometimes hard, partly because the witness position... It can be this is sort of the near enemy thing again, it can be a kind of enlightened position of just like observing the whole with a sort of magnanimous neutrality, a kind of God position. Or it can be a little avoidance.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I just watch, you know. You know, does anyone not know the movie Wings of Desire from like the 80s, Wim Wenders? It's a movie about angels, and it's an 80s New Wave movie, so the angels are these, like, tall blonde guys in black trench coats who stand on the edges of buildings in Berlin in the clouds, and they're sort of very quiet and still in their coats, and they appear in hallways, and nobody can see them. But it's the story of this angel who gets tired of being a kind of emotionally neutral immortal and decides that he wants to become human, and he falls to Earth, and ends up falling in love with this, you know, circus artist and goes to a bar and hears Nick Cave sing. It's great. It's awesome. you know. But it's about this same thing of, like, do you maintain this kind of cool, removed, you know, witness stance, which is a form of being an angel. It's a kind of eternal stance. Kind of, and it is one of the stances of the Buddhas, of the kind of divine beings, in a way. Or do you engage? Choose to be, and the choice to engage is in a certain way to let go of the beautiful island of pure mindfulness, right? To let go of that pristine witness position and be like, oh, I'm going to enter now.
I think one of my little beliefs in life is life is not a spectator sport.
Yes.
And it's, you know, we need to really participate in our lives and our communities and with our people, and
yeah,
it's really important to me. And in the work that I do as well. And so just being aware.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Not enough.
It's not enough.
It's not enough.
Right. And part of what I'm proposing is that it's not only not enough, it's actually just not, it was never intended for us.
Yeah.
It wasn't the practice for these people. It can be the practice if you choose to be that kind of person, and you can go and take robes as a monk or nun and live in that kind of pristine space for a time,
yeah.
In order to, and I think it's great that a few people on the planet, you know, hundreds of thousands, but compared to everybody, a relatively small proportion, choose to do that kind of thing, and one of my ongoing griefs is that that role is not available in America, right? That we don't have a thriving, supported monastic possibility. Where in other cultures, if you were the kind of person drawn to doing that, there would be a place for you. You could just do it, and it would be supported. And to have a few people doing that, Thomas Merton called monks like dynamos for a society, like just in their solitary cells praying, holding like some connection to something else while everybody else churns around them. But that's not us, you know. So
it also has the same, you know, it's like being not judgmental,
yeah,
not judging, but discernment is so important, right?
Yes.
So finding the balance there is also, for me, really something that I think about.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Again, you know, judgment and discernment are near enemies, right? This is a beautiful term that you brought in. Right, discernment is this wholesome quality. Judgment is mostly like discernment, but it has a little bit of hatred in it, or aversion, a little bit of negative projection in it. And so what we want to see is the aversion piece, and be like, oh, that, like, let's let go of that, but stick with the discernment, like really see clearly. Yeah, Stephanie.
So I agree with so much of what is being said about acting, and not just sitting back passively and being patient, you know, or using patience in that way and mindfulness in that way. But I am thinking, like, I know from my own practice, and I'm still working with this because I took an NVC course earlier this year, and one of the really important things for me, like particularly with communication with others, is even when I hear someone who I strongly disagree with, I want the opportunity to engage with them,
mm-hmm.
to possibly, like, not necessarily even try to change it, but just to have an open conversation with them so that they feel that possibility of having someone to talk to rather than feeling isolated and, you know, condemning them and saying, you're wrong, your
yeah.
view's wrong, your experience is wrong, like, get away from me, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult, especially considering some of the things we've been hearing
truly
recently. But like, it still feels really important to me. So a lot of my practice lately has been just listening and
mm-hmm.
like listening to others and like listening internally to see what, and sometimes it has meant that I've passed up opportunities to act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's I've learned a lot in that process to know when I really do need to speak, even though I didn't speak, you know, in that particular
yeah.
case. But like, just learning a lot about like internally what's going on with me. It's like, okay, when is it that I need to step in and say something really, and like, when is it that I maybe should listen more or
mm-hmm.
You know, chew on things a little more before I decide how to react.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Absolutely. And it's almost like as a training, we might notice that we have a tendency toward a certain kind of action, like habitual speech, you know. And in order to uproot the unwholesome aspects of that habit, I'm gonna hinge toward the witness side of the practice for a while. I'm just gonna watch, you know, and listen more than speak. And that would be, you know, a good thing to do. Like, that would be a training to unbind places that I've gotten stuck in the action side.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else who, you know, who's really good at witnessing and not engaging might practice, like, noticing all the moments where they had an impulse to engage and didn't because of a kind of shutdown
mm-hmm.
or contraction. And they might practice pushing against that and trying to be more spontaneous. You know, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to say it. Just say it. You know? And for them, that would be good training. You know, to come out of, again, the unwholesome or contracted aspect of their habit. So if we say that there's a spectrum, we're kind of identifying a spectrum between, like,
essentially passive and active, or witness and mover positions, either side of that can become unbalanced, or it can, or can become kind of tainted by aversion or grasping or confusion. And the process of undoing that, if I've gotten stuck in like always being in one side of that, will be to kind of lean toward the other side, right? So if I'm always jumping into action, to pause more and wait and observe. And if I'm always holding back and observing, to practice leaning in to action. So, yeah, beautiful. Thank you.
I like what you're saying, like you have to start from a mindful place in order, because like my issue is I get overwhelmed with emotions, like anger, mm-hmm. or just feel like mm-hmm. the weight of all the inequalities, and I feel like sobbing, you know?
Yeah.
Then I just act by my emotions without like taking that time to notice what's going on internally and then choosing to act mindfully. Like, I don't know if they're like two dichotomies, action and then sitting back.
Yeah.
They can become one. You can, can't you act and have that witness while you're acting?
I think that when that's happening, you're kind of vibrating quickly between them. At least in a Buddhist technical sense, you can only ever be in one mind state at a time. So you would be a very, very quick vibration, but you can't tell the difference, really. I mean, we do this all the time, right? I'm riding my bike. I'm constantly, like, noticing and reacting all the time. But if overwhelm is the state that's challenging, like, oh, there's just too much information, too much happening, too many feelings, then, you know, some space to, like, get sorted out. So it's like, oh, pause, come into a quiet, beautiful place, and just kind of process a little bit information, like let things swirl and settle and feelings to move through, and then be like, okay, now what really needs to be done, so that the action isn't coming from like a just do something, but coming from like a I've somewhat digested what's happening and now I'm gonna move forward, you know. And if you're talking about like, you know, the weight of everything, which God, please don't take it on.
Yeah, I know.
Like, just, you know, just don't. It's terrible. But
you can't read the news.
No, don't. News fast. It's okay. The good guys are going to win, or the less bad guys are going to win, and for now. And don't worry about it. But in that kind of thing, it's almost like the witness position has its lens too open, where it's like it's receiving so much information and noticing it and kind of processing it that the practice is actually kind of boundary practice in that sense. So like the action in relation to that overwhelm often, as I talk with folks whose experience is like this, is a kind of containing action, like don't read the news, like simplify, make a boundary, you know. I only take in this much at a time. And then I take solitude, or I go to safe social spaces. Like, I do what I need to do to contain that. And from then, the boundary where it's not overwhelming, feelings can be acted on or responded to in a more, like, organic way, right? Because it's not a waterfall. It's a reasonable creek, you know? Yeah, clear. It's clearer. We'll pause for the night. Thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here with you. As always, this group is offered in the sublime practice of the gift economy, undoing our capitalist training and insisting that all are welcome here, regardless of ability, regardless of access to resources. So those of us that do have access to some amount of resource and privilege, your generosity supports many others to come here. Who at any given moment don't have that. So thank you for your generosity. Donations go in the basket here, and they're split in half between the studio and myself. I will see you next week. I'll be gone the week after that. There will be a wonderful sub. I'll be teaching retreat with Pete Guinoso down at Vajrapani in the Redwoods. It's a mashup forest yoga and vipassana
retreat. So if you have a strong asana practice some sitting practice, you want to come and hang out in the Redwoods with Pete and me for three full days, and 2 half days in the ends. It's the 9th through the 13th, or the 10th through the 13th, something like that, Wednesday to Sunday, week after next. Info for that is on my website or his, or ask me, something like that. It's not too expensive. Otherwise, going into the new year, we're around, I'm not really going anywhere. I'm going to go on a light sabbatical where I'm going to stop a bunch of the other teaching that I'm doing, and there will be periods of this coming year, maybe a couple of years, where this is the only thing I'm doing. So, but this group will continue regardless. And then as that unfolds, I have plans to do some special practices, which I will tell you about. So,
we have to be
patient. Patient. Tolerate the discomfort. Enjoy your lives. Enjoy the rain. So blessings. See you soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.